8:30 a.m. at the Portland Marriott downtown in Portland. Shine is the annual brunch and fundraiser for the Q Center, a place of resilience, strength, and love. This year marks 15 years since Q Center began serving the community. At Shine, there will be a cabaret, brunch, and honoring of Q Center heroes. Again, that's Shine with Q 15 years on Sunday, December 9th at 10:30 a.m. at the Portland Marriott, 1401 Southwest NATO Parkway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Well, hello and welcome to KBOO. This is kind of a special edition tonight. We have with us Stephanie Lorenko. She's a captain at the Portland Police Bureau. She's the first transgender captain. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
At the police department, and she's running the traffic division. Sorry. We also have with us Jen Burlton of Transactive, amazing group.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie's been a member of the Portland Police since 1999. She was promoted to sergeant in 2005, then to lieutenant in 2015. She founded the Transgender Community of Police Officers and Sheriffs in 1998, which connects transgender police officers across the country. Jen Burlton is the founder and executive director at the Transactive Gender Center in Portland. She is internationally recognized as a staunch advocate for gender-diverse transgender children, youth, and their families. Stephanie?
Thank you.
Say hi.
Hello.
Introduce.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. One of the things I want to, before I forget, and this has come up before, but for the TCOPS, or the Transgender Community of Police and Sheriffs, I'm a co-founder.
Okay.
For that. We actually, there's a group of us, probably nine or so at the time, and we kind of came together accidentally. Through a professor that was doing a research paper back then on transgender police officers, and he sort of introduced us, and then we just stayed in contact and realized that we had the benefit of each other's support, and it was very unique at that time. So we organized, we created a website, and that group has grown since then, and is been run by now a retired police officer from California named Julie. So I want to make sure that part of the record is clear.
Well, I was wondering about that. It's like, did you do that by yourself or was there a group? So
no,
thanks
was,
for
yes.
clarifying that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jen, hello.
Hi, Gwen. So for those that don't know, Transactive has been around for about 11 years. We were the first national organization to specifically focus on providing education, advocacy, and support services for gender expansive, trans, non-binary, queer, gender non-conforming, gender fluid, gender creative, gender fabulous
children gender and youth. Fabulous. Gender fabulous, I like
fabulous,
that.
Gender fabulous, children and youth between the ages of 3 and 18. We continue that work. Mm-hmm. And we're, in fact, expanding that work. I'll have a pretty big announcement to make in about 10 days. But I can't say anything more than that now. So all the K-boosters out there, I'm sorry to kind of put you on the edge of your seats, but let me just say that I'll have a big announcement to make about how we're expanding the scope of that work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Can't wait to hear. Maybe we'll get it out of her before the end of the show.
What Not think, a Stephanie? Chance.
So... It's awesome work, you know. My heart goes out to the whole group, everybody that's doing it. And
I just want to add that I'm here tonight because Stephanie is probably not only one of my oldest friends in Portland, and even though we don't see each other as much as we would both, I think, like to, I still consider her one of my best, if not my best friend in Portland. And I don't know why that is. We just made a connection. I've known her for almost 20 years. And I was there when she was sworn in as a police officer with the Portland Police Bureau. And I almost made it to her promotion swearing in or re-swearing in or whatever they call
it. This summer.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I had another thing come up that I couldn't make it. But I'm here to support my friend and the amazing changes that she's been able to both witness and influence in the Portland Police Bureau, making it a more inclusive space.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jen. And yes, we've known each other since I came to Portland, and at that time, because I had come to Portland, I'd never been to Portland before. I had come here for the job, and I didn't know anybody. And I met Jen at somehow I got invited to a barbecue.
Yeah, out at a farmhouse somewhere in Yamhill County.
Yes, and Jen was there, and so we met, and it just I felt this connection. She's if you meet Jen, you get this real genuine person that is easy to like, and I've always been super impressed with her and her ability to work all kinds of miracles, and don't play board games and stuff with her. She's a genius, but
that's a great description.
Yeah, but it was really important for me at that time to be able to make that kind of connection and to have that kind of support, because I didn't know anyone in the community. And As a police officer, it really is a weird place for me, even today, but especially then, because people, transgender people or anybody in the spectrum, they can seek out and find community usually and find support. And I tried to do that, and the support's there, but once people found out what I did for a living, then that goes away.
Right.
And Jen wasn't one of those that said that was somehow a disqualifier for her friendship or her support.
Yeah, and it worked out nice because Stephanie immediately did a background check on me, and I had no outstanding felonies at the time. And so that made it a little bit easier.
At the time,
operative word there is at the time.
No recent troubles.
Right.
Well, awesome. I'm happy to be here with both of you, and I can't wait to get into more of this conversation about community and friendship and all of that. But I'm curious about your transgender story. Like, when did you know you were trans? You know, the whole regular
the
story.
Normal questions.
The normal questions.
Well, I think a lot of these stories are very similar. And I think I've also learned as I've gotten older that the context is so much different. I have a friend of my daughter's who had has a trans sibling, and within the last few years, and she had come to me and said, "Hey, what's the one thing that really, in your experience, what's that one thing that would have really made the difference for you?" And for me, going, you know, all the way back to pre-internet, pre-everything, mm-hmm. The one thing would have been that I wasn't alone. You know, right. And today I think that doesn't come up as much. You might not be able to find someone immediately, but you can get on the internet. You can find resources. You can find people. And you know, back when I was a child, that just didn't exist. So I think my experience, like a lot of people my age, was that I totally felt isolated and alone, and that there was nothing else on the planet that was going on that was like this. So for me, when I was, my earliest memory of all this was the word transgender didn't exist. There was no place right. to talk about mm-hmm. that. I thought for sure, you know, I was a little girl. And I understood that the parts weren't all right at the right. time, but I thought, you know, what does a 4 or 5 year old know about human development, right? I didn't know anything. So I thought, well, I guess this is just part of it. And at some point, you know, the right parts show up. I mean, and that everything was going to be okay. And so I just, you know, as a child, and I would, I remember, you know, I would dress up if I could, and I would play and do things. And I've asked my mother about this one thing that everyone used to think it was just adorable for me to introduce myself. You know, all these little children, they always say what their age is, right? With this mm-hmm. cute little voice, you know, oh, I'm 4, or I'm 5, or whatever. And I used to do that, but I added something that I've never heard another child add, and no one can really explain it, except how does a child know their age? They're told. How does a child know their gender, or to say their gender? They're probably told. And so I would say, I'm 5 years old and I'm a boy. and people, everybody thought that was just adorable. But as I thought about that over the years, I thought, why did that come up? You know, it's maybe at some point, and my mother doesn't remember. She doesn't know. No one else in the family knows. So I did. I just thought that at some point, you know, this whole thing would resolve itself. Of course, it does. It didn't, mm-hmm. and then reality slowly starts to creep into it, and you realize, no, this is, you know, you get what you got kind of thing, and you better figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because you don't realize that there are other people in that situation, you know, it's just scary. You don't know what to do. And in my case, I decided that I needed to try to just make the best of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes internal.
Right.
And stays there for a while.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I can, something Stephanie said about the internet making it easier. And just so the listeners know, Stephanie and I are about a half generation apart in our ages. Not quite a full generation, but about a good half generation, I think.
We're both over 50.
We're both over 50. Yeah, some of us are within a hop, skip, and a jump of 50, and some of us would need to take a Uber to 50. But we're both over 50. And I think that's absolutely true. But I also think that in some ways, and I have this conversation with parents and youth a lot in the work that we do, is that in some ways, if you live in extremely rural areas or things like that, where you're aware that there are other trans people out there and you're able to make internet connections, in some senses, if it's extremely difficult to still make physical connections, in some ways it's almost worse than when there was just the sense that there were no connections out there, because you didn't ever have this hope, this sense that you were missing out on something. It was just that, well, that's, as Stephanie said, you got what you got. That's just the way it is. When I was a kid, my generation, Gwen, you and I may be closer in I don't know.
I don't know either.
Well, I'm not going to make any judgments about that. You're probably closer to Stephanie.
Thank you, love.
Thank you. Welcome, dear.
Stephanie looks more like 40s. But
yes, she does look like she's in her 40s, mm-hmm. but she's not. She's not at all.
And I haven't been for a long time.
But like I've shared with youth, you know, when I was a kid, first of all, my only connection, Stephanie talked about, you know, us meeting and her feeling like this was a personal connection. Mm-hmm. For my generation, the only connection I had was a person named Christine Jorgensen.
Mm-hmm.
And she was unattainable, unreachable. She was just this person that was out there somewhere.
You but heard that, it. In yeah, the, you read it in the newspaper.
Among the other 3.5 billion people in the world at the mm-hmm. time. But that was it. And so in some ways it was like, well, I'm never going to meet her. So I'm not going to have this sense of longing. And there was also the whole thing about medical treatment. There was no option for early intervention or support. I hoped for it, but I never had any real expectation of it. And now I think for youth, now that they know that those possibilities are out there, sometimes it can be worse if they can't actually grasp them. It's sort of losing the thing that you know is there as opposed to not having anything to lose.
Yeah, it's... You know, I know in my experience, we're going to take a short break now. Welcome back. And we were just talking about how we felt at a younger age before we could actually do something about being trans or really recognize that feeling and share it. So that idea of having to go internal with this, you know, I mean, it just sets up, it seems like it sets up a long series of borders and blocks and fences towards other people. I mean, that was my experience, was hiding it then, you know.
Well, I know for myself, and especially a lot of the people that I had found a support group back in 96 or so in Spokane, Washington, and that was kind of that was the same experience with everyone that I knew then. For the most mm-hmm. part, was, mm-hmm. you know, try to hide it, try to outrun it, you know, do everything you can to avoid it. And I think a lot of us, you know, we didn't know what we were dealing with. And again, just trying to make the most of it. And for me, in my case, and I think a lot of people that I knew that were in there, that meant trying to be as hyper-masculine as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Mm-hmm. If I'm just more masculine, then these feelings, well, then they should go away, right? And if I live up to society's expectations, then I will find acceptance. And then, I mean, we know that that just doesn't work out that way.
Right, right. Do you have siblings? Do you have?
I do. I have a sister, and I have a half brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a half sister.
Somewhere out there.
That's an afterthought because I was...
Do you have any children that you know of?
Yeah, right. That was the next question. How we doing with kids over
well,
there?
Well, I try to be as much of an open book as possible. And it hit me that about, I don't know, 4 or 5, or I don't know, maybe even 8 years ago, my father called me. And he says, and I've always been the oldest child in the family, and the oldest of all of my cousins. And so, not that that did anything for me, but I was the oldest. And so, my father called me a few years ago. And he said, "Hey, I need to tell you something. You have an older sister." And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, she's a half sister." And he told me the story, in between different women that he was being with. This child actually was born first, but then she was put up for adoption, and then she was seeking out her family, and she wanted to know who her parents were, who her family was. So she had looked him up; she had found him, and then he felt compelled to let me know because she was going to be calling, and she did, and we had a nice talk. And so, currently, the count is a half sister, a half brother, and then a sister. But my father, I can't answer for that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
How have they taken your transition?
Well, my parents, my mom and dad, they've been divorced since I was nine, and that was after their second marriage. And I think in my experience, I didn't have a great home life either. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of chaos and turmoil and things that would take a lot longer to talk about than we have time for here. But my mother and my sister ended up in Virginia. And so my father stayed in Idaho. And the response was different because my relationships were different with each group of people, right? Mm-hmm. I'd been estranged from my mother for many years. And so I didn't really know her that much that's all been remedied, but so mm-hmm. I gave her the news, I gave my sister the news, and that was kind of a remote deal, long distance, and because I just sometimes do things spontaneously because it just feels right at the moment, I had sent her an email on Christmas Eve, and I don't know why, it just felt like that was the time, and so I did, and she was very accepting. And my father, I told in person, and he went through a lot of stages of, denial, anger, frustration. But we maintained a dialogue, and he has come to accept that, difficult to do. The one thing I had decided early on, regardless of who I was dealing with, family members, friends, whomever, I would never say anything out of anger. I would never say anything that I couldn't take back, because in the long run, I wanted to make sure I took the high road, whether I got the result I wanted or not. But if I don't take the high road, I knew I could never mend any of these relationships. So regardless
inner,
of
inner wisdom.
Yeah. So regardless of what happened, regardless of what I was, some of the things people said to me, which were very unpleasant. I always took the high road, and that I think has really helped, because with almost all of my family at this point, I mean, we're talking 20 years now, but I have relationships with all of them.
Nice.
Yeah.
That idea of being careful of what you say, how you say it, and not being reactive to, especially what your family and friends are feeding back to you is amazing.
Well, and as a police officer and people, I supervise people and I mentor people at work. That's a good thing, just for in general. But at work, I tell people, be careful. With the how's it goes. Keep your from day to day. Keep your words soft and sweet, because you never know from day to day which ones you'll have to eat. And
Farmer's Almanac, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Farmer's
Almanac. Is that what that is?
I can't sure, remember. Why not?
Yeah.
Or Reader's Digest.
Sure. I can be a little folksy. I've got a lot of country in me.
Let me just go on the record as saying I have not always taken the high road. I've not. Let me just say that that Stephanie has shown more growth and self-control, as I used to see on my report card a lot in elementary school, than I ever did. I was always very much like, I'm in an adversarial relationship with the world, and don't get in my way.
So. I'll go on record as not going on record. But yeah, more with Jen. Right.
I'm not saying one is preferable over the other. I'm just saying.
No, but that meal of words that you wished you hadn't spoken is.
Since it's just the three of us trans women talking here and nobody's really listening.
Right.
You know, we're not all from the same cookie cutter.
Oh, gosh. So I'm curious what you did before you came to the Portland Police Bureau.
Well, I was a police officer in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Oh, were you?
Before that, I was an Air Force security police dog handler. Uh-huh. And before that, I was a Marine Corps Reserve attached to an artillery battery in Spokane, trying to go to college. And I came to Portland because my transition in Coeur d'Alene didn't go very well.
Right?
Yeah.
I can get that.
But it was
Coeur d'Alene
it was,
sounds like it would, but
why?
Then
have you been to Coeur d'Alene?
It sounds like, you know, a little nice, French, accepting Coeur d'Alene.
Well, I think again, context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think today Coeur d'Alene is not the same Coeur d'Alene that it was in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1998, when I had in consultation with my family, with my wife and my children, we'd had this plan, and part of that plan was to quit and walk away. And I didn't have the expectation that people could manage that kind of information back in 1998, whether it's Coeur d'Alene or anywhere, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And so my coming out was rather accidental and haphazard. And But it was a saving grace because it allowed me to continue my career. Because when I did come out, the first person I came out to, who was a lieutenant, he was in charge there, and he shocked me because he was like, "Is that it? Is that all?" And I thought, "What's going on here?" And then he talked to our chief and he said, you know, you have to talk to the chief. You have to give him a chance to decide whether or not he wants you here. And the chief of police at that time, you know, I mean, he was big, you know, guys. They're all macho guys. And he was super intense. He listened to me. And when I was done, he simply put his hand on my shoulder and said he would be proud to keep me. And I was pretty blown away. And then it came to, well, how do we do this? How do we make disclosures? How do we manage people's expectations? We can't call Jen and say, "Hey, can you come do some transgender training over, you know, in 1998? And so it really was something of, you know, telling people individually and then doing a like a memo. And of course, the outside world finds out, and then they want a piece of this. And you have media crawling up in your business, and they're not particularly supportive. And so...
They're curious.
They're curious.
But they're not supportive.
Right. Sure, sure. And I wouldn't expect that. But so there's a whole whirlwind of things going on now that I didn't plan for, didn't expect. And of course, I'm still trying to manage my transition, and I'm trying to deal with the hormones, and I'm trying to deal with the pressures of everything we had planned and to make this work. And so a lot of people, what I found through that experience was the number of people that came forward to support me was unexpected. There were a lot. And so I found that anybody can surprise you.
Uh-huh.
With their support, and anyone can hurt you, you know, by walking away. But at the end of the day, it came down to the rank and file, and who do you share the streets with? Who do you count on to be there for you? And if they can't be there for you, and if they can't support you, it becomes very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually. Had to look around for another job. And I applied in several different places, and I told them up front, this is what's happening in my life, this is what's going on. If this is a problem for you or your agency, do not call me. Do not respond. I understand. Oh. It's okay. Mm-hmm. let's not waste each other's time. I had applied in Portland, King County, and Seattle, and all three places were very open and welcoming and said, no, please come here and interview. And so that's what I did.
Wow. You just never know.
That's true.
My I have this idea of a police department filled with, you know, men, policemen, and kind of rough and everything, you know. I mean, just that more male energy. And I'm really wondering how that is for you today. Like, does being trans come into play in your daily, you know, conversations with people or interactions, and just how is that?
Well, not with my coworkers, not in the workplace. Really? Now, when I was brand new, and because I was suffering from, you know, some temporary, you know, lack of. I was naive. Let's just say that I was really naive. I thought, well, I can come from Coeur d'Alene, I can go to Portland, and nobody's gonna know. Right, I can just be me, fresh start.
Fresh female police officer.
Yeah.
Right.
Your
right.
story won't follow you from Coeur d'Alene.
Right, I transitioned, you know, they have no before, Stephanie, memory, names, none of that. So there's there's no excuse for pronoun slip-ups. There's no, none of that. And so I interviewed, I got hired, it was great. I got sworn in. You know, and then I would be in line for coffee at Starbucks, you know, by the precinct downtown, and I'd have, and I wouldn't be wearing a uniform. I'd have people that I didn't know come up and say, "Hey, Stephen, how are you doing?" And I'd be like, "Oh, I'm fine," you know, and then this became sort of a thing. And then I finally, one time, I turned to the person, I said, "I'm just fine. Who are you, and how do you know my name?" And of course, what was happening was, They knew before I got here, because there were people who had friends, people, Portland police officers who had friends in the Coeur d'Alene Police Department. I didn't know about that.
Oh.
And so people in the Coeur d'Alene Police Department were telling their friends in the Portland Police Department, "You're not going to believe what's going on over here." And then eventually it was like, "Well, she's coming here." And I would be
on the road.
Yeah. And so I would be on a call, too, as a new cop with my coach, and be out there trying to do my job. And I would get a cover car that would show up to a Southeast Portland call. That cover car came from downtown. And I'm like, "You don't even work over here. What are you doing?" And, you know, of course, as I learned later, they're checking me out. And and now over time, all that has evaporated. And this doesn't come up ever.
Wow.
And so... I mean, it might if it's contextual or relevant, mm-hmm. but it doesn't, you know, which is great. I mean, there's a lot of people I'll have conversations with, and I'll start talking about my history, and they start to have this real weird look on their face, like, that doesn't, you know, playing football in high school. Wow, that must have been remarkable. And I'm like, no, okay. And then I kind of have to come out. Of course, being promoted to captain, that kind of did it for me all over again.
Right.
And I don't have to worry about that. But there were lots of conversations where I was such a non-topic that people didn't know, they forgot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that worked, I think, to my benefit in a lot of areas.
I kind of have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
To that is, do you think, so it stopped being news in the bureau over years,
right?
And then it just became, you had a whole new cohort of officers who never knew you as anything other than Sergeant Lorenko or Lieutenant Lorenko or Captain Lorenko. Do you think that there's been a change just in also that if people did find out, do you think there's been some type of cultural change or mm-hmm. Or departmental climate change that would mean that that the people wouldn't be like, oh, we have a trans officer. Okay, as long as she does her job.
Well, it's like a lot of things. It's not going to be one thing.
Right.
You know, it's mm-hmm. just in society, I think we can all mark that, you know, in the last, well, not counting the last couple of years, but for the last, you know, 10, 20 years, there's been a lot of progress on social issues and transgender issues in particular. Mm-hmm. And but at the Portland Police Bureau, one of the reasons I came to the Portland Police Bureau was because I wasn't going to be the first. You know, when I came in, I did a ride along, and you know, the Damon Woodcock had transitioned, and then after Damon, Jesse Morgan had transitioned, and the officer that I rode with, I had no problem with that. It was mm-hmm. he was kind of like, yeah, you know, I mean, this is not a problem here, and so I think there was a beginning of a culture change with them, and so I carried that forward. But the most important thing to any police officer or anybody in the community, if they, you know, their expectation is that you can do your job.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And the one thing I really stayed focused on whether it was Coeur d'Alene or Portland or anywhere, was to be the best cop that I can be, because especially in Coeur d'Alene, you know, people are always trying to tear you down, trying mm-hmm. to take away mm-hmm. things that are who you are. And in that case, my thing was, you can say a lot of things about me that aren't good or accurate, but you'll never ever be able to say that I'm not a good cop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I you have to stay focused on what's important and what your values are, what your goals are. And so that's what I did with that. And once the other cops know that, you know, you're not you don't have a chip on your shoulder, you're not trying to carry along an agenda, you're just trying to be a good cop. And they come around. And I think that I can't do the kind of advocacy work that Jen does or that you do or that so many others have done openly and publicly year and year and year. And so my way of doing that is to represent, just be the best version of who I can be, so that everyone I work with gets a really good impression, and they go, yeah. And so when it has come up, they've said, oh yeah, you know, I work with a transgender cop and she's great, or I she's my supervisor. I can say that hands down, everyone that I've worked with has, when they've worked with me, we've had great relationships. They've been extremely supportive, and I've enjoyed all of that. The only time I have problems is people who I haven't worked with the police bureau, and they form their opinions based on overall public perception that always mm-hmm. isn't good.
Right, right.
I also want to say something. Among the many things that Stephanie has done in the communities, Stephanie was very key in the Women's Strength effort to teach women self-defense.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Which we know is certainly needed. Mm-hmm. It's something that is long predated the Me Too
mm-hmm.
Visibility, and so Stephanie has always used her skills to bring additional benefit to the community. And the other thing I want to say is, as a longtime member of the Portland area advocacy, Stephanie also came to Portland at a time that I think was very fortuitous, in that during the mid to late 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, there were citizen council groups that were specifically doing much mm-hmm. more outreach on LGBTQ issues, mm-hmm. specifically working with Portland Police Bureau. And so the community-based advocacy groups played a really large role in educating the department and other aspects of the municipal governmental agencies. And I think it was all very synergistic mm-hmm. in how that happened.
Yeah, and that's in one of those groups now. It's rebranded as Alliance for Safer Communities. But they continue to meet and do that kind of work. And in my particular case, too, when I came on board, the chief had already had decided it was going to be successful for me, and he had laid a lot of groundwork and kind of had people go ahead of me to different places and say, you know, this is gonna work, and I better not hear otherwise. Well, it was nice, but really the intent was just let me get my feet on the ground, let me build my own reputation, and through that I've been able to do other work, participate in training. I mean, there are, like a couple of years ago, I did I was part of a role play for a hostage negotiation team. And how would they deal with a scenario with a transgender suspect that was having a crisis? And it was a real scenario from a real event that had really happened in another state. And we led up, you know, several days of training leading up to that with other transgender officers to try to educate this team who were 100% invested in getting this right. And then once we did all this training, then we went into a live scenario where I spent half a day on the phone and doing this role play and really in some ways getting triggered and crying and making them go through the hoops.
Oh, wow.
It was an emotional thing to go through. That program lives on, and in fact, they wanted me to participate in more in Eastern Oregon, and they actually wanted me to do it from inside the Oregon State Penitentiary. I'm like, you know, I'm not going to do it from inside.
Jen Wood.
Yeah. So my presence has opened a lot of those doors, and I think, and a lot of that awareness inside that people don't know. And can't really appreciate because they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the people I supervise. As a sergeant, I had a small team I supervised, and they knew what my values were, and they knew who I am and where I come from. So they meet those expectations. When I supervise investigative units, when I read their reports, when I talk to people. And now, of course, I have a division that I'm responsible for, and everyone there, they know what my expectations are. And I think what that does is that ripples out into the community and has a positive effect that is really hard to get in any other way, which is why we need more transgender and gender diverse people in the police bureau so that they can have that same kind of influence in other divisions and other areas of work.
So that seems like a great place to kind of go into. It's like if we're talking about, you know, change in consciousness or change in, you know, big movement change that is not ordered, so to speak, is not, people are doing it by choice as opposed to doing it by being told to. That kind of change comes from more people being in the police force, more people being in connection, because what you talked about, the groups that you've been in and what you've done, I mean you don't read about that stuff,
right? Well like TCOPS, I mean, we have somewhere around 100 members right now that are actually members, and others that we consult in agencies. And I've mentored other police officers locally. I've had other police officers reach out to me personally, as all our other membership. I have had Portland police officers who have family members who have come to me and said, hey, you've really helped me with this because I have this person in my family. I even know of other police officers that are no longer Portland police officers that are also transgender now, but they're still closeted. And so so the influence, you know, you can't measure all of this, you know, but it all has an effect, and it's all important work.
You know,
deeply important.
Deeply. I mean, it's deeply important. It's no secret that there is, and I certainly hear from these people a lot because of the work that I do,
mm-hmm.
puts me directly engaged with people that, with trans people and gender diverse people who might not have had positive experiences with the police department mm-hmm. for one reason or another. And I certainly hear what they're saying, and you know, I listen, and I understand that in many cases, their concerns are really justified. But I use a couple of, you know, for me personally, I have a couple of thoughts about how change happens. And one of the primary ones is that, let's take the medical field, for example. Medical care for trans people began to take a huge leap forward when more trans people became medical providers.
Right.
When more mm-hmm. trans people were actually doing the care and taking what they knew into their profession, even if they hadn't received that training in medical school. Until recently, and in certain places where we're really ramping up what competence, trans care medical competence looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in any of the professions, and particularly those that are A, necessary to maintaining a stable society, in one case for healthcare, in the other case for maintaining public safety. Stephanie and I have had some significant disagreements. And at one point, it felt to me like our friendship might break up over something that I said. And I'm not going to go into what it was. But the way I look at it is that I'm a trans woman. And knock on wood, I have not had the negative. I've never been bashed. I've never felt physically harmed, although I've been threatened. Mm-hmm. I've gotten death threats for the work I do. But I've, unlike many of my sisters and brothers, have not personally been damaged by that. If I were, I know for me personally that as much as it would be lovely to have somebody like Jen come running up and asking how I could help, I'd rather see a patrol car come up with two officers, step out and say,
mm-hmm.
how can I help? And it's the world we live in. And what we have to do is we have to not rail at and lump all police officers and all police practices into one lump group. We have to make a commitment to infiltrating the police department.
There's Jen. Infiltration.
Yeah, well, that's where change is going to happen, and uh-huh. that's what needs to happen. And yeah. So that's kind of where I come down on the community's relationship with the police department. We need to be vocal when they don't get things right, and I am. Stephanie will tell you that I am, but I love the fact that I can be vocal to my friend Stephanie, who is now a captain
mm-hmm.
in the police department, in the Portland Police Bureau, and who is a trans woman. And I'd much rather take my concerns to her than some cis white male dude who's just hearing the word trans for the first time.
Definitely.
Well, and I would much rather hear about the negative, the problems that we have at the police bureau, and how I can be a part of any solution to those problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't discount that people have had you know, bad contacts with the police either. You know, that the police bureau has some history that, you know, we need to make sure that we are addressing, that we've apologized for, we are not without sin in this career field. But in 30 years, I've been doing this job for 30 years, what I can say is we have continued to march forward with doing a better job. And I want that to continue. I would not discount any of the contacts or the stories that Jen might be concerned about, you know, because I know that those are real. But I know that they don't get better if we're not doing something from the inside. Having people come from the outside and provide training or provide advocacy or sit on boards, that's all important. But the officers respond by example.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. they need, and our culture has changed because people have from the inside changed it.
Yeah, it sounds it's a work in progress, And I think all of us are. But the idea that there's willingness and participation in that change is, I'm hoping people hear that.
Well, for me, it wasn't even just about transgender issues. It wasn't right, about right. when I came to Portland. As a young, I get a little emotional because I get a little emotional in part because I've been doing this for 30 years and I really haven't seen the kind of change I would have hoped for. But when I was a young cop in Coeur d'Alene, so you're talking about, I started in 88. And it might have been around 1989, 90, but there was we got a call about a man hitchhiking on Government Way, which is a north-south main road in town, and he was an African-American man.
Mm-hmm.
And, there aren't a lot, especially then, there weren't a lot of African-American men walking around Coeur d'Alene. And so I was sent out there to, you're not supposed to hitchhike, but I was sent out there to talk to him about that. And when I pulled up, he threw his hands in the air. I hadn't said anything. I was not threatened. I did not ask him to do that. I just pulled up in my car. I wanted to have a conversation with him. And I said, hey, man, I was trying to reassure him. It's okay. Just put your hands in. I just want to talk to you. And he said, no. I'm going to stand here with my hands up during this whole contact. And I didn't really know what to think about that. Mm. He says, if you shoot me, I want everyone to know that my hands were in the air. And this was long before the hands up, don't shoot, and all of the other controversies that you hear today. This was almost 30 years ago. And it just broke my heart that, that's when I really got a taste of, we don't all get to experience this country the same way. The rights and the freedoms that so many people have and take for granted. And so, I hurried up with my contact, and he, true to his word, he kept his, and I don't mean he kept his hands up shoulder high. I mean, he kept his hand, his elbows above his ears high. And I hurried through that contact, and I drove away, and I never forgot, that experience and what it must be like to have to be like that. And so, I've had my own stories of as a transgender woman, with threats from police officers, mm-hmm. police officers I worked with not being allowed to be seated in a restaurant, with being denied employment, with being denied housing, with everything else too, and so the issue for me has been a lot bigger than just. Advocacy for transgender people. It's really just it's for everyone,
mm-hmm.
so that everyone should have the experience of that this country is supposed to promise to everyone.
Wow, and, I like it.
Yeah, and to follow on what Stephanie shared, the ongoing struggle in this country is that the ruling majority. In whatever area in which you're ruling, either whether it's through governmental power or it's just through majority rule, or now, as far as white Europeans go in the United States, we know that it's minority rule. White Europeans are becoming a population minority in this country. And I don't know why that's a problem for anybody. But all the power still lies within that population.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ongoing struggles is that the ruling majority often does not know what the lived American experience is. And Stephanie's memory there reflects that. But in the interest of full transparency, there are a lot of people that are not happy that I'm here tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's been made clear to me. Why am I here? Why am I looking like I'm giving support for the Portland Police Bureau? Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm here for my friend, who I love.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephanie's been my friend for 20 years.
Which, by the way, was the original idea.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But I'm also here, first of all, if anybody knows me, the best way to get me to not do what they want me to do is to tell me not to do the opposite. But look, I believe that dialogue mm-hmm. is always has a place. And I believe that outrage does have a place when it's warranted.
Uh-huh.
But I believe that dialogue is always should be the first path. My friend Stephanie is captain of the traffic division of the Portland Police Bureau. She's a trans woman. That has never happened in this country before. And if I, as someone who people think of as a, I don't think of myself this way, but as a leader, as an advocate for a certain aspect of this community, mm-hmm. if I'm not willing to have dialogue with this person, with my friend Stephanie, then I am missing out on a huge opportunity to participate in positive change as opposed to standing in the way of it.
Hear, hear.
Well, thank you, Jen. And I really do appreciate that. And, you know, anger and outrage is only going to get us so far in organizational and cultural change. And so, you know, I need more people, you know, like Jen, you know, the Portland Police
Don't
Bureau.
Go too far. We need more people.
Yeah.
Well, we are rounding the corner here to the end of our time, and I just want to say how much I appreciate you coming on and talking about your life and your experience. I feel the same way Jen does. If we can't have this conversation, we're not going anywhere.
We got to keep talking to each other. We've got to keep talking to each other and assuming whenever possible until proven otherwise that we have our community and our population's best interests in mind. And I believe that under Stephanie's guidance, that's going to happen in the Portland Police Bureau. And
sounds like it's happening.
And she's a captain.
Yeah.
Right.
But thank you,
Gwen, for doing this show and for opening up this platform, because there were some concerns. Having friendly dialogue about LGBTQ issues with.
Well, and I would like to just add and finish. I've not done interviews with any other media other than OPB. Uh-huh. And in part because there's very specific people I want to talk to that I think are helpful, and I think the audience for KBOO is that audience, because I want them to be part of the solution. I want if you're out there and you've ever thought you wanted to be a Portland police officer, you know, go online, look it up, do that, be a part of the solution here. That's I think the best way. You're going to have the support and encouragement to do it. And I encourage people to do that. But I don't do media. I'm an introvert. this sucks for me. But I'm here because I think it's important. And I'm here at KBOO. I mean, like Jen, I mean, there's a lot of cops. Like, you're going where? You're going to go talk on what radio station?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, because this is the audience that we should be talking to. This is our community. These are, you know, the people that we need to have involved. So thank you for having me and allowing me to say those things.
Well, welcome. And as far as I can say, you are always welcome here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gwen.
Clean, and there's nobody singing to me now. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yo, man, it's a lot of brothers out there flaking and perpetrating, but scared to kick reality.